I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Hey, Change Surfers, I'm all fired up this week because I attended a healthcare forum in my district. I have not been to a town hall meeting of this sort in a very long time, to my memory. But because of the right-wing campaign to attack and shut down these informational meetings about healthcare reform around the country, I was mobilized to go and attend this local one in Woodstock, Connecticut, which is a very bucolic little town with lots of little private prep schools in the area. And this was held in a very beautiful little school called Woodstock Academy, looking out over an incredible valley from the cafeteria that we were in. According to the newspaper, there were 350 people crammed into this meeting. I wouldn't have guessed that number. Some of the other people who've written about this meeting online guessed, as I did, about 150, but the newspaper said 350, of whom about 30 to 40 were teabaggers, these right-wing groups who had been mobilized, some of them to the right of the Republican Party, libertarian groups and people like that. And then there were at least 30 or 40 of us Netroots single payer types. You could tell from the applause that single payer got every time it was mentioned. And then there were a lot of local Democratic Party type folks. The front seats had been fortuitously reserved for the local Democratic leadership. And that's I was sitting up with them because they saw my Obama cap on. And it was about the closest thing to a riot I've been in. Now, you know, I may be exaggerating because I went looking for a riot. I went looking. I went looking to beat down some right wingers. I have to confess. And so I was vibrating the entire time, expecting escalation. And it was a very raucous and contentious meeting. And it has, in other places, escalated to fisticuffs, as you can see in YouTube happened down in Florida. And there have been death threats from these groups in the past and so forth. But so maybe it wasn't quite as close as I had anticipated, especially since the Democratic folks clearly outnumbered the right-wing nuts, 5-1, 6-1. I also realized afterwards that a number of the big burly guys that I had been eyeing uncomfortably before the event started turned out to be from the local carpenters and steelworkers union who were there on our side as loyal supporters of the Democratic healthcare reform cause. So they would have taken care of things quite handily, I think. But at any rate, there was lots of shouting about the socialist takeover of healthcare. There was like repeated calls, where in the Constitution does it say you can take over healthcare? To which the congressman, Joe Courtney, who was just brilliant through the entire event, he just was able to keep his cool and respond to each increasingly bizarre question as if they were a serious person instead of someone, you know, phoning it in from the next dimension. But he kept repeating that it was, he said, in the Commerce Clause of the Constitution that the federal government could regulate interstate commerce, and that the Supreme Court had always interpreted this to mean that the federal government could set up things like the Veterans Administration and Medicare and so forth. And of course, there are all these claims that this was going to be single payer and Canadian style socialism and blah, 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 when in fact this proposed healthcare reform is nothing of the sort. And unfortunately, if it was single payer, you know, if we're going to take all the brickbats for proposing single payer, why don't we just propose single payer? Because, you know, the wingnuts attack us, healthcare reform advocates, for wanting to nationalize healthcare, even though Obama very carefully through the entire campaign and through this entire political season has excluded the single payer folks from the debate and intentionally tried to court the insurance industry and the AMA and all the traditional foes of healthcare reform, and in some cases has succeeded, such as with the AMA. and with the pharmaceutical industry, which is just delighted with this bill. And it's not a single-payer bill. It's a bill that may and probably will not include a public option that people could buy into if they wanted to. Okay, so what were some of the other crazy things that were shouted out at this meeting in Pomfret, Connecticut? Well, there was the shout about a notion that this legislation was going to require that everyone get euthanasia, which, of course, was a reference to the fact that it is proposed in the legislation, the House version of the legislation, that there be reimbursement for 1 hour consultation every 5 years with a doctor about advanced care planning, including healthcare powers of attorney and advanced directives. Now, in 1990, we enacted in this country the Patient Self-Determination Act, which is a bill that that requires that hospitals inform patients that they have the right to refuse any medical treatment or not refuse any medical treatment, and that they have the right to have a healthcare power of attorney and ask them if they have one, and that they will put it on record if they do. So if you have a do not resuscitate order or whatever. Now, you would have thought that that legislation being on the books for 20 years, like, you know, the notion of brain death being on the books for 20 years or Supreme Court precedents for pulling the plug on people who were in permanent vegetative state have been on the books for 20 years. You'd think that all those things would have been picked up on. But of course, the right is a little bit slow on these issues. So they accuse this reimbursement for a 1 hour consultation with your doctor about advanced clear planning as mandated government sponsored euthanasia, when ignoring the fact that we've already had a law on the books for 20 years requiring hospitals to talk to you about your advanced care plans, and that neither of these things involve euthanasia, and because euthanasia is illegal. You know, that when they discovered Terri Schiavo was going to have the plug pulled on her, there was like suddenly a hullabaloo when for 20 years we've been pulling the plug on people like Terri Schiavo. Anyway, the right's a little slow about these things. But what was fascinating about the wingnut at this meeting who was going on about government-sponsored euthanasia, which she also read then an excerpt from an article from the British Medical Journal about priority setting in healthcare, which Zeke Emanuel, you can find this online, Zeke Emanuel, who's one of the chief healthcare policy advisors to the administration and is the chief bioethicist for the NIH and a very prominent bioethicist, and who I actually, having read his book on healthcare reform in the early 90s, I modeled my proposals for a transhumanist-themed healthcare system, universal voucher system, basically, on what Zeke Emanuel had proposed, which was fairly similar to the Clinton proposal of 94. At any rate, Zeke Emanuel is a great guy, and he's written a lot of very influential things, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of things. This article that she quoted from January 2009 was about how to do priority setting in healthcare and how it would change the distribution of resources in healthcare. And he pointed out, as he and his two co-authors pointed out, as many people do when they do this kind of priority setting exercise, that basically folks over 60, we spend a lot of money on folks over 60, and we don't spend as much money, or we could spend more money on people under 60 and get a greater bang for the buck across the lifespan, do more preventative healthcare, more healthcare for kids, and get a greater bang for the buck than spending so much on curative medicine at the end of life. Now, I'm going to talk about that in a second when I get back to one of my favorite themes of longevity medicine. But at any rate, this meeting got me vibrating, you know, about this question of whether these teabagger groups are a threat to democracy. Now, I remember very clearly, I wasn't there because I was too young, but I remember very clearly the discussion on the left in the 70s and 80s about whether the way that student left had treated professors or the various groups that they targeted in the 1960s was anti-democratic, you know, that shutting down meetings, shouting down speakers and so forth. And this has been a consistent problem about whether, you know, what are the bounds of civil discourse? What is the legitimate role of civil disobedience in the face of being excluded from public deliberation or from having a voice in the public square? And in this case, you know, I think like the single payer folks who've been excluded, they had a right to disrupt some of the meetings that they have disrupted in the last couple months to say, you know, you have consciously excluded a policy option that's favored by 30-40% of Americans. And on what grounds do you call this a discussion of healthcare reform when single payer is excluded? Okay, I agree with that kind of civil disobedience. Now, why shouldn't I also agree with this organized AstroTurf campaign by a bunch of insurance and right-wing foundations and the Republican Party and Fox News to intentionally shut down these Democratic information sessions about healthcare reform? What's the difference? Well, the difference is that these are total wingnuts. They know nothing about the legislation. They are not arguing for any particular kind of healthcare reform. They, you know, occasionally there was applause for tort reform at this meeting, as if reducing the amount of malpractice insurance in the country, or, you know, changing the way that we sue doctors was going to change all the things that are wrong in American healthcare. The people who gave personal testimony at this meeting about the fact that they had been excluded from coverage because of pre-existing conditions were shouted down and shouted at as that they could get healthcare from other insurance companies, that they were liars, that they hadn't tried to do that, when clearly because of their cancers or their kids' diseases, they had found that they were unable because of a private health insurance in the United States to get coverage. So at any rate, the difference, I think, is that this is a kind of brown shirt movement. I referred to it in some of my correspondence over the last day as brown shirts, and some people responded, so how could you be calling for civil discourse and be calling these people brown shirts? And I said, well, you know, there are brown shirts in the world. There are people who want to shut down our democracy. Now, I'll give you an example. There was a guy at this meeting who got up and said that he had escaped from communism in Chile, which immediately, if you know the history of Chile, they never really had communism in Chile. They had a democratically elected socialist government, briefly, Salvador Allende. And then he went on to say that, yes, Salvador Allende was a communist. He had taken over Chile. And then the people rose up and threw out this this communist dictator, Salvador Allende, actually a democratically elected democratic socialist. And the people rising up, as you remember, was a CIA-backed fascist coup. Salvador Allende was overthrown by Augusto Pinochet, who then went on to kill thousands and thousands of leftist demonstrators and imprison them and disappear them in Chile, and set up a right-wing economic regime there to test out the theories of the Chicago School. So, when I hear that kind of rhetoric at this kind of a meeting, and then he, of course, was exhorting the crowd, or at least speaking to his supporters in the crowd, that they needed to stop the spread of Marxism in the United States, that Obama was a Marxist trying to establish a Marxist dictatorship, and that we Americans needed the same kind of people rising up as they had seen in Chile, the people rising up against Salvador Allende. In other words, he was calling for fascist coup in the United States. So now, is it hyperbolic? Yeah, maybe I'm a little hyperbolic about this, but we're in the greatest depression since the 1930s. What was the last time major world powers were taken over by fascist movements? It was in the 1930s. The Republican Party is increasingly a party of racists and reactionaries and people on the far right. And so I was taken when I saw this article from Campaign for America's Future by an argument which I usually do not, I usually am not open to the notion that that it's the responsibility of progressives to call things fascism and fight fascism. But I thought that this was a relatively well-reasoned article, and I just want to read a little bit of it to you. Fascist America, are we there yet? All through the dark years, this is by Sarah Robinson, by the way, and it's from the Campaign for America's Future at ourfuture.org. All through the dark years of the Bush administration, progressives watched in horror as constitutional protections vanished, nativist rhetoric ratcheted up, hate speech turned into intimidation and violence, and the president of the United States seized for himself powers only demanded by history's worst dictators. With each new outrage, the small handful of us who'd made ourselves experts on right-wing culture and politics would hear once again from worried readers, is this it? Have we finally become a fascist state? Are we there yet? And every time this question got asked, people like Chip Brulé, Dave Neuwirth, and Fred Clarkson, and yours truly, Sarah Robinson, would look up from our maps like a parent on a long drive and smile a wan smile of reassurance. Well, we're on a bad road, and if we don't change course, we could end up there soon enough. But there's also still plenty of time and opportunity to turn back. Watch, but don't worry. As bad as this looks, no, we're not there yet. In tracking the mileage on this trip to perdition, many of us relied on the work of historian Robert Paxton, who's probably the world's preeminent scholar on the subject of how countries turn fascist. In a 1998 paper published in the Journal of Modern History, Paxton argued that the best way to recognize emerging fascist movements isn't by their rhetoric, their politics, or their aesthetics. Rather, he said, mature democracies turn fascist by a recognizable process, a set of five stages that may be the most important family resemblance that links the whole motley crew of 20th century fascisms together. According to our reading of Paxton's stages, we aren't there yet. There were certain signs, one in particular, we were keeping an eye out for, and we just weren't seeing it. But now we are. In fact, you know what you're looking for. It's suddenly everywhere. It's odd that I haven't been asked for quite a while, but if you ask me today, I'd tell you that if we're not there right now, we've certainly taken that last turn into the parking lot and are now looking for a space. Either way, our fascist American future now looms very large in the front windshield, and those of us who value American democracy need to understand how we got here, and what's changing now, and what's at stake in the very near future if these people are allowed to win or even hold their ground. So what is fascism? The word's been bandied about by so many people so wrongly for so long that, as Paxton points out, everybody is somebody else's fascist. Given that, I always like to start these conversations by revisiting Paxton's essential definition of the term. Fascism is a system of political authority and social order intended to reinforce the unity, energy, and purity of communities in which liberal democracy stands accused of producing division and decline. Elsewhere, he refines this further as a form of political behavior marked by obsessive preoccupation with community decline, humiliation, or victimhood, and by compensatory cults of unity, energy, and purity, in which a mass-based party of committed nationalist militants, working in uneasy but effective collaboration with traditional elites, abandons democratic liberties and pursues with redemptive violence and without ethical or legal restraints, goals of internal cleansing and external expansion. According to Paxton, fascism unfolds in five stages. The first two are pretty solidly behind us, and the third should be of particular interest to progressives right now. In the first stage, a rural movement emerges to effect some kind of nationalist renewal. They come together to restore a broken social order, always drawing on the themes of unity, order, and purity. Reason is rejected in favor of passionate emotion. The way the organizing story is told varies from country to country, but it's always rooted in the promise of restoring lost national pride by resurrecting the culture's traditional myths and values and purging society of the toxic influence of the outsiders and intellectuals who are blamed for their current misery. Fascism only grows in the disturbed soil of a mature democracy in crisis. Paxton suggests that the Ku Klux Klan, which formed in reaction to post-Civil War Reconstruction, may in fact be the first authentically fascist movement in modern times. Almost every major country in Europe sprouted a proto-fascist movement in the wretched years following World War I, when the Klan enjoyed a major resurgence here as well, but most of them stalled either at this first stage or the next one. As Rick Perlstein documented in his two books on Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon, modern American conservatism was built on these same themes, from mourning in America to the rapture-ready religious right, to the white nationalism promoted by the GOP through various gradients of racist groups. It's easy to trace how American proto-fascism offered redemption from the upheavals of the 1960s by promising to restore the innocence of a traditional white, Christian, male-dominated America. This vision has been so thoroughly embraced that the entire Republican Party now openly identifies itself along these lines. At this late stage, it's blatantly racist, sexist, repressed, exclusionary, and permanently addicted to the politics of fear and rage. Worse, it doesn't have a moment's shame about any of it. No apologies to anyone. These same narrative threads have woven their way through every fascist movement in history. In the second stage, fascist movements take root, turn into real political parties and seize their seat at the table of power. Interestingly, in every case that Paxton cites, the political base came from the rural, less educated parts of the country, and almost all of them came to power very specifically by offering themselves as informal goon squads organized to intimidate farm workers on behalf of the large landowners. The KKK disenfranchised black sharecroppers and set itself up as the enforcement wing of Jim Crow. The Italian squadristi and the German brown shirts made their bones breaking up farmer strikes. And these days, GOP-sanctioned anti-immigrant groups make life hell for Hispanic agricultural workers in the U.S. And by the way, at this rally, this event for Joe Courtney, there was lots of talk about anti-immigrant hate. There was lots of clapping on the part of the teabagger wingnuts whenever there was any mention of the cutting off health care to illegal immigrants. As violence against random Hispanics, citizens, and otherwise increases, the right-wing goon squads are getting basic training that, if the pattern holds, they may eventually use to intimidate the rest of us. Paxton wrote that succeeding at the second stage depends on certain relatively precise conditions, the weakness of a liberal state, whose inadequacies condemn the nation to disorder, decline, and humiliation, and political deadlock, because the right, the heir to power but unable to continue to wield it alone, refuses to accept a growing left as a legitimate governing partner. He further noted that Hitler and Mussolini both took power under these circumstances, deadlock of constitutional government produced in part by the polarization that the fascists abetted, conservative leaders who felt threatened by the loss of their capacity to keep the population under control at a moment of massive popular mobilization, an advancing left, and conservative leaders who refused to work with that left and felt unable to continue to govern against the left without further reinforcement. And more ominously, the most important variables are the conservative elite's willingness to work with the fascists, along with a reciprocal flexibility on the part of the fascist leaders, and the depth of the crisis that induces them to cooperate. That description sounds eerily like the dire straits our congressional Republicans find themselves in right now. Though the GOP has been humiliated, rejected, and reduced to rump status by a series of epic national catastrophes, mostly of its own making, its leadership can't even imagine governing cooperatively with the newly mobilized and ascendant Democrats. Lacking legitimate routes to power, their last hope is to invest the hardcore remainder of their base with an undeserved legitimacy, recruit them as shock troops, and overthrow American democracy by force. If they can't win elections or policy fights, they're more than willing to take it to the streets and seize power by bullying Americans into silence and complicity. When that unholy alliance is made, the third stage, the transition to full-fledged governmental fascism, begins. The third stage, being there. All through the Bush years, progressive right-wing watchers refused to call it fascism because, though we kept looking, we never saw clear signs of a deliberate, committed institutional partnership between America's conservative elites and its emerging homegrown brown shirt horde. We caught tantalizing signs of brief flirtations, passing political alliances, money passing hands, far-right moonbat talking points flying out of the mouths of mainstream conservative leaders. But it was all circumstantial and fairly transitory. The two sides kept a discreet distance from each other, at least in public. What went on behind closed doors, we could only guess, but they certainly didn't act like a married couple. Now the guessing game is over. We know beyond doubt that the teabag movement was created out of whole cloth by AstroTurf groups like Dick Armey's Freedom Works and Tim Phillips' Americans for Prosperity, with massive media help from Fox News. We see the birther fracas, the kind of urban myth-making that should never have made it out of the pages of the National Enquirer, being openly ratified by congressional Republicans. We've seen Army's own professionally produced field manual that carefully instructs conservative goon squads in the fine art of disrupting the democratic governing process, and the film of public officials being terrorized and threatened to the point where some of them required armed escorts to leave the building. We've seen Republican House Leader John Bonner applauding and promoting a video of the disruptions and looking forward to a long, hot August for Democrats in Congress. This is the sign we were waiting for, the one that tells us, yes, kids, we're there now. America's conservative elites have openly thrown in with the country's legions of discontented far-right thugs. They have explicitly deputized them and empowered them to act as their enforcement arm on America's streets, sanctioning the physical harassment and intimidation of workers, liberals, and public officials who won't do their political or economic bidding. This is the catalyzing moment at which honest-to-Hitler fascism begins. It's also our very last chance to stop it. So that was a piece from ourfuture.org, which was also reprinted at alternet.org and a number of other places. It was by Sarah Robinson. I didn't get a chance to finish it here. I urge you to take a look at it. So briefly, I want to mention a couple other things. One is that there is a wonderful piece from the Center for American Progress, which, of course, I'm always citing stuff from the Center for American Progress here. I'm a big fan of Center for American Progress. But nice piece by Henry Fernandez called Rules for Dealing with the Radicals. And he talks about this campaign that's been organized by these AstroTurf groups to attack the Democratic town halls, and how they're, you know, how it's tied in with a lot of fringe organizations and racist groups. He talks about the anti-immigrant stuff that you hear at these meetings, the how it ties into the Council of Conservative Citizens and other racist organizations, and how the birther movement itself is a racist campaign, the notion that somehow Kenyans conspired to elect a black president in the United States and pretend that he was born here when he wasn't. I mean, the idea is just full of racist conspiracy theory. And so I urge you to take a look at this. This is a nice kind of summary of the whole problem of how we deal with this phenomenon, because on the one hand, we have to uphold, who are for civil democratic discourse, have to uphold the value of civil democratic discourse. And if they do behave at these meetings, we can't shut them out of these meetings. But on the other hand, we have to recognize them for what they are, which is an organized effort to disrupt democratic discourse about healthcare reform with the most bizarre, uninformed, stupid conspiracy theories that are right out of, you know, the protocols of the Elders of Zion. So I urge you to take a look at this. This is again at AmericanProgress.org, Rules for Dealing with Radicals by Henry Fernandez. I also want to urge you to look up the 10 healthcare points that every Democrat must repeat. Now, ordinarily, I wouldn't be for just sloganeering of this sort, but these are perfectly legitimate healthcare points. Look it up. 10 healthcare points every Democrat must repeat. They're the 10 facts about the healthcare reform and the crisis of healthcare that we're in this country that I think are incredibly helpful. Okay, so I used up all my time with a rant against the right, and check back next week and I'll talk about something a little bit more substantive. Thanks. Bye. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.